This is a podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Imagine this, though. You're at the footy. You're watching your favourite team. It's a pretty close game, too. And you have seen the big hits taking place all through the game. Or maybe in a soccer match, football match, a lot of headers. So, then, however, one of your favourite players, one of the big stars of the team, one of the most important players in the game, gets knocked over, hits his head on the ground, or gets hit in the head high tackle, or gets knocked out. He or she sits up, shakes their head, gets back up, a bit wobbly on their feet. How would you feel? What are you thinking then? Are you saying, get back into the line, we need you? Or are you saying, oh no, time to come off, that's okay. There's only a point in it. There's only a few minutes to go. We can do without you. Because in 40 years' time, you're not going to be the person in the nursing home helping that same player get up, not from the field, but out of their chair when they can't remember what's going on. Concussion is one of the most controversial issues in modern contact or collision sports, or even other sports as well. You might have seen Ed Cowan. He's played Test cricket for Australia. He got hit right in the middle of the forehead. He was wearing a helmet the other day in that Sheffield Shield match. He had to go off. Took no further part in the game. Did not play in the next game either. He suffered from concussion from being hit in the head by a cricket ball. We saw what happened with Phil Hughes. We know how dangerous it can be. But what would happen if there was maybe two runs to go with an over left in an Ashes test or something like that? Would he come off? Would the game be called off? How would you feel about it then? Because you're not the person who's going to be helping him later on when maybe he's suffering some severe head trauma or early onset dementia because of what's happened on the field. There was the new movie, Concussion, starring Will Smith, is about to hit Australian cinemas. In fact, I think it opened yesterday, and its focus is on the National Football League in the US. And I suppose that is about the doctor who kind of worked out that something was not right with some of these ex-players, former NFL stars. Some of them ended up homeless because they lost their mental capacity because of the hits they took on the field. There was a time when you'd get knocked out, and you'd go back out again to prove how tough you were as a player. It has become evident that there can be both short and long-term implications associated with heading back out onto that field. Joining us now is Dr. Adrian Cohen from HeadSafe. It's a charity dedicated to the prevention of head injuries. Dr. Cohen, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Rod.
And thank you so much for your time. Why did you start HeadSafe?
Well, it's a long road to where we are today, but back in the mid-80s, I was a doctor working in hospital and started a part-time volunteer job on the Westpac rescue helicopter, which was kind of an interesting side gig for a doctor. It took my medical skills and paired them with an interest in the outdoors. So suddenly, instead of just being in a hospital waiting for people to come in, I was out there scraping them off the street, abseiling over cliffs, jumping out of the aircraft itself or being winched down. And I got a taste for what we call pre-hospital medicine, which is to say everything that happens before somebody ends up in that nice, well-lit emergency room. And I enjoyed it. It suited my lifestyle and it suited my interests. And I also started to realize that, you know, it wasn't just the presence of a paramedic at the scene, but it could be any kind of first responder that really made the difference. Now, during that time, we did a lot of head and neck injuries. In fact, my mentor in this field, Professor John Yeo, ran the spinal unit at Royal North Shore Hospital. And we delivered to him and to the spinal unit at Prince Henry Hospital about 70 spinal injured patients in my first year. Now, that's more than most doctors see in their entire career. And here we were at car accidents or at people that had fallen over cliffs or been dumped in the surf or at football games where we suddenly were dealing with people with severe head and neck injuries. And I realized at the time that we didn't handle them particularly well. And the research that was coming out of Australia at the time showed that 1 in 4 people, 25% of people, got worse from the time of their accident or injury to their actual arrival in hospital. And this is the work of a doctor by the name of Joe Toscano, who looked at the statistics and the records of 18 months of people who ended up in the Austin Hospital Spinal Unit in Melbourne, and then went and interviewed them. And in his thesis that came out of this, he delineated not only, you know, who was involved in the accident and how it had occurred, as much as was known. He spoke to bystanders and to third parties and the police. But he actually went in to find out what sort of symptoms they had at the time of their initial injury and then what happened by the time they got to hospital. And that startling figure that 1 in 4 got worse came to mind. The sorts of scenario we had and the sorts of things I then experienced as a doctor were going out to pick up a patient, say, from one hospital to bring to another, and being told a story like this. You talk to the patient, say, what happened? He says, oh, you know, I was out mountain biking with my mate. We're on this trail. We jumped this huge log, came down, smacked into a tree. I was immediately sore in the back, and my friend went for, you know, for help. And about an hour later, the ambulance came bumpity, bumpity, bumpity over the ground. Got to me, said, how are you? Okay, back's a bit sore. Can you move your legs? Yeah. Okay, they bundled me onto the stretch into the back of the ambulance, off to the way to the hospital. We get to the hospital. How are you? Good. What happened? You know, mountain bike accident. Back's a bit sore. Can you wiggle your toes? No. Oh, said the doctors. Ooh, better do an x-ray. Ooh, look, there's a disruption. Can you feel this? No. Can you move this? No. Okay, we'd better ring the spinal unit and tell them there's a spinal injured patient on the way. So that's the type of scenario that, right, whilst at some extent wholly preventable, you sort of think, why wasn't that person immobilised and treated with kid gloves from the outset?
Yeah.
We'd get head injured patients who just told similar stories, you know, when they finally came around, saying things like, you know, nobody realised what was going on at the time. And I thought, well, we could do better than this. This is not a trivial injury. This is not somebody, you know, missing that fracture in the hand and I had to put a cast on and, you know, the cast was on for 6 months instead of 6 weeks. These are significant injuries where initial care can make a world of difference.
Okay.
So I got interested in it.
So let's talk about concussion then. The idea, not the movie, although it's a pretty good movie. What is concussion? What actually happens when you have a concussion?
That's a very good question, and the answer isn't as obvious as you'd think. You know, in the old days, concussion was being knocked out, right?
I always kind of assumed it was like your brain hitting your skull or something.
Well, that's what happens. But let's go right back to the basis. And a lot of this information comes from an international consensus of concussion in sport. There's been three of those held over the last 12 years, the most recent one in Zurich. So often I'll talk about things like the Zurich Committee or the Zurich Consensus.
Right.
And definition is really important, because not only is it important to realise what concussion is, it's also important to mention and recognise what concussion is not. So why don't we start with that? So the scenario that you depict where somebody has a head injury, becomes unconscious, can't be roused, gets rushed into hospital, they do an MRI or CT, find some bleeding into the brain, call the neurosurgeon, he drills a hole into the skull, evacuates the brain, and the person gets better in the best case scenario. That's not concussion. That's a bleed into the brain. And that's the worst case scenario, and that's what a lot of the preventative and immediate treatment's all about. Let's just make sure this isn't a bleed. But the definition of concussion is that it is, and here I'm going to quote, a complex pathophysiological process defined by a number of signs and symptoms that typically arise rapidly and resolve spontaneously over a sequential course that's caused by a physical force. In other words, a biomechanical force of some kind that results in the brain, as you said, moving inside the skull and resulting in a whole set of signs and symptoms.
Okay.
So it's not a bleed, yeah. And we've got to realise that, you know, the brain doesn't have a built-in shock absorber. It sits inside that hard case of the skull, inside some shock-absorbing fluid called cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF. But it doesn't have muscles, and it doesn't have springs, and it doesn't have ligaments, and it doesn't have tendons, and it doesn't have the normal things in the rest of our body that cushion blows. Mm-hmm. It's just this fluid, and it can rock back and forth. And you can have the actual blow directly on the skull affecting the brain substance underneath, but you also have the brain moving inside the skull and striking the opposite side of the skull, what's called a contra coup or opposite side injury. So it's a force that affects the brain and causes a whole lot of different signs and symptoms.
Okay, so the interesting thing is, I think, that only about 1 in 10 concussions result in somebody being knocked out. So they could be getting, say, if you're a football player or you're playing some sort of sport like that where their head clashes are constant, you could be getting concussions all the time and not know about it. So is there any kind of safe concussion?
Well, you raise an interesting point. I mean, firstly, you don't know about it because you're being affected. And one of the things that happens is that your judgment goes off. So when I hear footballers say, "I was fine to go on," we say, hey, by definition, you weren't in a position to judge.
Yeah.
So let's start with that. So all these guys are going, "Oh, it was okay." That's great in hindsight. But when a concussion happens, there's a variety of things that we can pick up. There's no real mild, moderate, severe concussion. I hear those terms a lot. It's like mild, moderate, and severe pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not. So let's look at concussion. If you're knocked out, you're concussed, but less than 1 in 10 are people that are knocked out. So we've got to look at the signs and the symptoms. The symptoms are something that a person will experience and discuss or complain of themselves, and the signs are something that the trainer on the field, physiotherapist looking after the team, or the doctor on the sideline will be able to elicit. So those symptoms are either somatic, like a headache, and that's the obvious one. I've got a headache. My head hurts. They may be cognitive, like they're feeling in a fog. I've had my bell rung. I'm dazed. I'm dinged. I'm not thinking straight. And there's actually, interestingly enough, emotional ones as well, which range from people being overly aggressive to people being overly quiet. So they're the sort of symptoms that somebody might experience. They may feel themselves being uncoordinated, but that's something more often that we see. So when you see a player get up from a big hit and stagger and not be able to hold their feet or require somebody else for support, that's an obvious sign that they haven't got their balance, they haven't got their coordination. Interesting, when I talk about those emotional symptoms or behavioural changes, they can be irritable. And so I think we've probably seen images of players coming from the field looking like they're arguing with the medical staff. Or, you know, and we understand that there's lots of pressure on people to stay on the field, to get back to help their team, and it might just be that. But it may also be a symptom of their concussion. So whilst we go, hey, this guy's a hero, he really wants to get back on there, he really wants to help his team, we've also got to realise that he may be experiencing the symptoms of concussion and be being irrational.
Okay. So then you'd have to think that in modern sport, and perhaps in old-time sport as well, I got a text from John in Newcastle, and I remember this case. I think Jeff Astle was the player who played for West Bromwich Albion. He died a couple of years ago, played in the 60s when they used leather balls and the fields were water-soaked. He was heading a lot, and so, you know, they attributed his death to constant heading of the ball. So that's just one thing with soccer, where you don't have head clashes like you do in league, union, AFL, that every player would be suffering, you know, multiple concussions possibly every game. So why is it that maybe only about a quarter of them are presenting later on, maybe, or maybe they aren't, maybe all of them have this, say, CTE, which is the problem that the movie deals with and that many of the players are presenting with, and we only know after they die. That's the only way you can actually test them. Why is it that it seems like not everyone has them, has this condition? Well, they should all.
There's a spectrum of injury. So let's start with the person at one end that gets knocked out. Very obvious. Now let's get the person that gets up from the field, or, you know, girl riding a horse with a helmet on, gets thrown from the horse, smacked on the ground, gets up dazed and confused. Again, using you know, our knowledge now, we can look at that and go, yep, we get it, that's concussion. Then there are the fact that those people, like Jeff Astle, like people playing soccer, like people playing many other sports, sustain many sub-concussive injuries. Now, what does that mean? I'm going to use that term a couple of times, sub-concussive injury. That is an impact or force to the brain that doesn't cause the signs and symptoms, but nonetheless, when you come down to the very basics of the physics, imparts energy to the brain. And the brain is either moving directly, the direct force, G forces, or being rotated inside the skull. And you know, you think of the brain as this, we've probably all seen one by now, as this large fleshy mass. But when it comes down to it, the brain is in fact trillions of nerve cells or neurons, all with a very specialized function, and all with the unique property of actually communicating with the cell next to them. Now, if that function is disturbed, they don't communicate with the cell next to them as well or as quickly. So whilst we see a sign or symptom on the outside, which we describe as a functional disturbance, you see, when you take a hammer and smack somebody on the knee, they start bleeding. You can see that. You can actually see what's going on. But you can't with concussion, because it's down at the cellular level where those nerves aren't moving the electrolytes in and out of the cell as well as they should. The neurotransmitters, the chemicals that help one cell talk to the next cell, aren't being secreted in the same amounts. And you have this process go haywire, this incredibly complex process. We're talking trillions of cells. We're talking more humans that have ever lived on the planet, all on the side of, inside each and every one of our brain. That process is going wrong. So at a cellular level, that's the damage that's being done. Okay. And I've just mentioned too that when that happens, that might release some chemicals or damage chemicals, which we call biomarkers, which we'll later pick up. But those subconcussive blows do damage. Now, the acute ones, the big ones, the big hits, the obvious knockouts, the people that are uncoordinated, are taken off the field staggering, we can see what's going on. But the question that we ask is, if they're having multiple large concussions, we get that, and we can see that that might be the case. And that's some of the, you know, the gladiators in our sports that we revere for how tough they were. But there's also people who sustain damage week in, week out, training and playing. And Jeff Astle was the first player in Britain to actually be diagnosed with this condition called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, at autopsy. It's only an autopsy diagnosis at the moment. And his brain was donated, and they asked the neuropathologist to have a look and to see what was going on. Yes, the balls were heavier. Yes, they got wet. But when I come back to the basic definition, we're talking about force. And when I went to school, force was mass times velocity. So whilst the ball is lighter, it actually moves faster. So if you're looking at the total force in the game today of football or soccer, then what you find is that there's probably just as much force. And we know now, how sport has become more scientific and more professionalized and coaching has moved on, people are told to practice and perfect the skill time and time again. So the players perhaps in the 60s and 70s, they were working men who went to play soccer on the weekends. Mm. And then they'd get out of the pub and have a few pints. Now, if you want to make it in football, you practice the skill, whether it's bowling a ball, hitting a table tennis ball, or heading a ball thousands of times a week to get it right, to get your skills right. And the people that are excellent at sport have, you know, wonderful control of their body and of the ball, if it's a ball sport or their equipment. So repeated subconcussive blows, whilst not having the dramatic knockouts or taken off the field from concussion scenarios, may well have long-term damage, which results in the condition of CTE.
Okay, by the way, we should remember that Jeff Astle did score the winning goal in the 1968 FA Cup final, and tragically, to make matters worse, it was against Everton. But, you know, we often see players taken off the field And then people say, oh, for their own safety, they should have to stand down for a week or so, or they, you know, they're left out to recover. If they have already suffered the concussion or the head injury, does waiting another week or 2 weeks before they play again really make any difference?
Well, let me ask you this. If you've ever damaged your knee and you've had a ligament injury, or you've a cork thigh or a bruise, what do? You rest it and it gets better.
But does a concussion get better if, as we are seeing now years later after these players die, that they're suffering or they suffered from CTE, and we don't know about that until they die and do an autopsy of their brain, but if the damage is already done, does it get better by letting them, you know, not play for a week or 2 weeks?
And the simple answer to that is yes. The body is a remarkable machine that tends to heal itself. So if you give people the opportunity to recover and to rest without going back into training the next day and to full contact with other players as they get ready for the game the next week, in over 90% of the cases, the people will be better within 7 to 10 days. And the brain has healed itself. What we're concerned about when we look back historically about people who have suffered is they didn't get a chance to rest. They were sometimes put back on in the same game.
Yeah.
And so they didn't get the chance for that, so there was more damage done.
Okay.
So the message out of all of that is, let's let the people have the time off to recover the same way you would if you had a knee injury. You know, you strain your medial collateral ligament on your knee, everybody knows you're going to be sitting on the sideline with ice on it, and you're going to be out for 3 weeks, and you're gradually going to be coming back.
So,
but for a long time, we didn't accept that with blows to the head.
Yeah. So with footballers, of course, some of them might get through a game without getting a blow to the head. That's all right. With some other people like boxers, they get hit in the head dozens of times during a fight. Are we seeing, you know, is it far worse when it comes to boxing rather than, say, football? And all the, I mean, people have talked about punchy fighters, or we see what happened with Muhammad Ali and many other boxers. Surely this is, it's worse for them than footballers.
Undoubtedly. Look, boxing is a sport with the sole purpose of causing a head injury. How do you win your fight?
Yeah.
You knock the person out, or you have them TKO'd because they can't stand. So these conditions were first described in boxers, and the damage to the brain at autopsy was described by surgeons and pathologists from the early 1900s. So they could see the damage to the brain. And before these boxers died, the condition was given a name because they often were demented early or lost their marbles or had lots of psychological problems. And the Latin term that was given to this description was dementia pugilistica. In other words, dementia caused by fighting.
Mm.
And so what Dr. Bennett Omalu, who is the subject of the film Concussion, found as a pathologist was that he was seeing the same sorts of changes in the brains of footballers that had been described in boxers. And so he said, wow, it's the same process, damage to the brain, but this time not caused by boxing, caused by the sport they were playing.
Dr. Adrian Cohen is our guest, director and founder of HeadSafe. And if you'd like to talk about this or ask him a question, then by all means, please do. Mike talks about microconcussions through severe acceleration or deceleration, as in Formula One racing. What do we know about that, Doctor?
Again, you go back to first principles. What are we talking about? We're talking about force on the brain. So if you subject the brain to force, either constant or very short-term high impact, then you cause damage. You know, one of the great philosophers of the 24th century said to his captain, and I am talking, of course, about James Montgomery Scott, or Scotty on the Enterprise, Captain, you cannot change the laws of physics. You know, the damage is done by the force. So if you can show that there's force exerted on the brain, you can bet your bottom dollar there's going to be a long-term effect. Now, it's different with two footballers running at each other. Muhammad Ali, when he hit somebody, was estimated to punch at about 60 G force. We know that racing car drivers and jet fighter pilots may sustain 10 G going around a corner or accelerating through a curve. But we have recorded, and this is the other interesting thing, we're actually recording impacts with footballers now. and we are recording impact of up to 180 G at maximum and regularly over 100 G.
So that's what possibly three times harder than the hit that Muhammad Ali would give to somebody.
That's exactly right. So the duration is very much shorter. Obviously, with a blow than being a jet fighter pilot, going around a steep curve. But the G-force recorded is higher. And the other thing that I mentioned earlier before was that it may also be the rotation of the brain, which we measure, again, with the types of impact sensor. And we use a tiny little thumb-sized sensor called the X-Patch from a company in America called X2 Biosystems, which sits on the back of the skull and records impact during the duration of a game. And the study we did last year with the Randwick rugby team, we recorded every single game and then correlated that with the number of concussions we had during the year. And we regularly found that players, on average, were experiencing around 100 impacts per game of over 10 G and maxing out, as I said, at 180 G. So there's a lot going on, and there is, over the course of one game, 1 week, 1 month, one season, a cumulative effect of those blows, whether or not they cause concussion or not, okay. the forces add up. And that's, if we can measure that, we can manage it. So we may get to the situation when, even if somebody doesn't manifest the signs of concussion because they're knocked out or have an injury on the field where they're staggering, uncoordinated, and get taken off, we can measure enough and say, you know what, you've had enough that we know that it's going to cause injury if we let it continue, so we're going to sit you out for a couple of weeks. And that's using technology that's available now to prevent problems down the track.
Okay, we'll take some calls in a second. I just want to ask again what someone has texted about, and that is about headgear. Now, we see in America, it doesn't help them. They've got those big helmets in football, and that doesn't help because the number of footballers who... they have brain damage because of getting hit. Maybe it's because they lead with their heads. Maybe it's because they feel safer with helmets. In Australia, we see blokes with soft headgear. People like Jonathan Thurston wears it, or Steve Menzies used to wear it as well. I was always told it was so that you could get noticed by selectors in junior competitions, that the bloke with the headgear always stood out. Does headgear do any... does that help you in any way?
No, it doesn't. In fact, the studies have been done in Australia because, harking back again to what goes on in the actual impact, we're not talking about headgear like some magic protective force field around your head that absorbs all the impact. It's not an airbag that absorbs the impact like the one in your car. All it does is stop superficial lacerations or grazes, because when it comes down to it, that force is still there. The brain still moves inside the skull. And whether the blow is to the head or to the body, it's transmitted through to the skull. So headgear has no effect. And American-type helmets, they really don't work either because they don't absorb the impact. Now, there's research going on with, all sorts of new materials and all sorts of new cushioning in there saying, oh, it's going to do this, it's going to do that. And if it does, fantastic. But the head, the way that it's used in America, as you allude to, allows people to either run with their head down, or block, or tackle with their head down, and that is actually part of the problem as well. Okay. But American footballers come to Australia and see rugby league, rugby union, AFL, I can't believe these guys sustain these hits, and they're not wearing any protection. Well, funny enough, again, go back to it, it's force. The force of two heads clashing inside a helmet or two heads clashing without the helmet are still the product of their mass of the person, and people are getting bigger and their velocity, and we know that these days they're getting faster as well, so the impacts are heavier.
We've got a lot of people who want to talk to you, and let's try and get through all of them. Let's start with Virginia. Good morning, Virginia.
Good morning. I just wanted to just tell you a very quick story. When I was about 10, I went to the show, and I had a ride on this machine called an octopus. And the actual suit, there were about six of us in each suit, and it spun round in circles as well as shooting across and then spinning round and round, shooting back. And I couldn't hang on about halfway through the five-minute ride or two-minute ride. I couldn't hang on anymore, and I was so scared I was going to fall out. But when they stopped, I couldn't stand up. I couldn't walk.
Yeah.
And for about 4 days, I couldn't move. I had to be taken home, put to bed.
Yeah.
And then ever since then, Well, if I turn my neck really quickly, I get this feeling like, and I imagine it's blood, but it's probably not, this fluid, it feels like it sort of like shoots up from the back of my neck like fingers over the top of my skull.
Yeah,
and it doesn't really hurt, but it's a bit sort of scary.
Oh, that's awful, Virginia. Now, admittedly, Dr. Adrian Cohen is a doctor and director and founder of HeadSafe, but he's not about to give medical advice in specific to people, but can speak generally about it. What about what Virginia was saying?
Well, it's interesting, and Virginia, your experience is unusual from the point of view that, you know, most concussions don't occur on the octopus, but I'm sorry that you've had those problems. You know, when you think about what's going on, whether or not you're talking about your vestibular system, your balance system, and when you talk about things moving and rushing, you know, that sounds like we're in that province. And your balance organ has been disturbed, or whether it's actually been due to the fact that there's been damage there, you're exhibiting a symptom, because we don't have a concussion meter. We can't run a magic device over your head and go, oh, yes, you've got concussion. We've got to infer what's going on by your symptoms. So your symptoms sound like those of a balance issue, and that takes you to the province of the ear, nose and throat surgeons, and they'll show you lovely diagrams of the semicircular canals in your head where our balance organ, our balance, comes from. And there's fluid within those canals, and it moves in all three planes as our bodies move in space in all three planes, and relays information to our brain where we process it and where we tell our body to correct it. So when you start, if you stand up and start spinning around to the right and you stop, your brain starts, you know, says, oh, I've stopped, but that semicircular canal fluid is still going around, and your body moves in either the opposite direction or steadies yourself using the cerebellum, which is a bit of the back of your brain that controls coordination. It sounds like that's gone awry with you and your symptoms have continued. Now, I mentioned that most symptoms of concussion go within 7 to 10 days. The ones that don't and that linger, that upset people a lot, are obviously headaches that continue, but also balance disturbances.
Okay.
And when this happens, this is called post-concussion syndrome, and it's like chronic pain. We're starting to deal with a symptom of the actual problem long after the original impact.
Okay. A couple of people texting about helmets. Are bike helmets useless? And what about horse riding helmets?
Well, they're useful for protecting the skull from fracture and from stopping that catastrophic bleed inside the brain. And we all know that being hit in the temple is a bad thing. You know, you're always told to stay away from that, kids, and that's why you wear a... You know, we are actually trying to make sure that the brain itself is protected and the blood vessels inside the brain stay entire. So if your skull fractures, it's those blood vessels which may actually rupture, and then you're in a scenario where you get a bleed.
All right, so helmets do more than just protect your brain. Obviously, they, you don't want to get a fractured skull. Neil, good morning.
Hello, Rod and Dr. Cohen. I had a series of rear-end car crashes. The last one was in 2011. I noticed after that I was having mood changes and aggression and difficulty controlling my emotions.
Terrible.
Yeah, well, there's certainly signs of concussion, and post-concussive syndrome is categorized by changes in emotion as well as the physical ones, as well as, you know, the somatic and headache ones that we talked about before. And when you're in that scenario, then you're looking for changes and treatments that really target what's going on with you. So, you know, what you've experienced is well documented and well known, and in sportsmen who've been subjected to multiple head injuries, it's well seen.
Yes.
In the stories that are coming out of the US, there are lots of ex-players who have problems down the track, not just with balance, not just with their joints, not just with headaches, not just with visual disturbances and concentration, but also with their emotions. Sometimes it's depression, anxiety, sometimes it's becoming withdrawn, sometimes it's acting out and becoming less inhibited. And then you add that to the fact that, you know, in sport there's a culture of drug and alcohol abuse as well, and you're kind of trying to work out whether
there's a link,
chicken and egg,
well,
you know, which
exactly
is causing itch.
And in fact, in the movie Concussion, that's brought out very well, certainly the aggression with a family, within a family, because of the footballer. Wendy, good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, you're talking about your sister.
My sister, who is in her early 70s, falls over so many times.
Right.
And her head has been hit so badly. She's had... It's just terrible.
Yes, I can hear that,
Wendy. And I'm just so concerned. But if she's not had a fall, she doesn't complain about headaches, but she complains that she feels foggy in the head.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, has she been to a doctor, though, Wendy?
Sorry?
Has she been to a doctor?
Oh, yes, but not about that.
Well, I think she should. I'll just say that, Wendy, and thank you very much for your call, because it's obviously concussion or head injury is more than just about footballers or sportsmen and women, increasingly women these days. Dr. Adrian Cohen is our guest, founder of HeadSafe, and is director there as well. Obviously, you see a doctor. If there's a problem, you see a doctor, and especially, for older people who might be falling over.
Well, we know that falls in the elderly are a significant cause of morbidity and of hospitalisation. But not all doctors are created equal, and not all doctors are concussion specialists either. So typically what happens, and we focus on sport because it's graphic, it's on television, and, as a culture, it's very important to for those of us in Australia and in other countries as well, I should say. But essentially, if you have a problem that's recognised early, you get referred to a hospital, and then you usually spend a minimum of 4 hours where they do the neurological observations, making sure your pupils are the same, making sure your reactions and your tendon jerks are the same, your sensation, your movement's the same. That's called neurological observations, and that's done for 4 hours. And if things change or there is evidence that these things are affecting one side of the brain more than the other, then you'll often be rushed off for a CT or an MRI because they're looking for that bleed into the brain because there's a surgical option for treatment there. But in most cases, about one in five people who end up in hospital go and have a CT or an MRI, and the majority of them, well, in concussion, they're all normal. So concussion does not show up on a CT or MRI. No point going to hospital saying, my kid was playing sport, yeah, they had an injury, I want them to have an MRI, because the doctors will make the decision whether there's a need for it, knowing that in most cases, concussion is the diagnosis, and therefore the MRI will be more important. There's no point spending money on an expensive test when you don't need to. It's not going to tell you anything. It's not going to make the person any better. So
we must surely need a better concussion test then.
We certainly do. So we firstly have to get some objective evidence about what's going on. So there's all these sideline concussion tests that are now part of the sideline standardized concussion assessment test, or SCAT, and that SCAT test came out of the Zurich consensus. There's a couple of apps now on phones that you can use to just go through and see if there are signs and symptoms.
Okay.
We use our impact monitors, that X patch, to see whether the blows have been significant enough to suggest we need to be testing more. We use a sideline test called the King-Devick test, which is a 2-minute iPad-based test of people's reading and scanning skills to see whether they're slower than they were when we tested them before. I spent last night testing over 75 players at Randwick Rugby, so we've got a baseline for the season. Now if they have an injury, we can see, how do you compare to how you were before?
Does every club have that these days?
No, they don't. And that's something that they need to bring in, baseline testing for sportsmen every season, and after every injury, to be able to compare to see what they were like.
Interesting. Dulcie is with us as well.
Yeah.
Hello, Dulcie.
Yeah, good morning. I'm harking back to 1945. I brought my husband back from Borneo on discharge leave, and he tipped getting out of the seaplane and badly injured his head. They called it cerebral hemorrhage, but it was found when he went to military hospital that it was a concussion. And he lived to the grand old age of 96, lost his hearing, which was, a bit traumatic. But I was just letting people know there is hope after injuries to the head.
That's a very good point, Dulcie.
Exactly.
I'll get Dr. Cohen to comment on that. Just because you hit your head doesn't mean you're going to, suffer later in life.
No, you're not. It's like every other injury. We have a remarkable ability to repair. 1945, didn't have a lot of CT and MRI back then, and so the diagnosis was purely clinical. But these days, the other thing that we're using that I alluded to earlier, There's chemicals that the brain secretes when it's injured. And we use chemicals for a lot of tests in the body. If you go to hospital with chest pain, the first thing they do is check the enzymes that a damaged heart secretes. And if they are found in your blood test, they go, right, you've had a heart attack. We've got the ECG changes as well. But we've also got these biological markers. Now, when you damage cells in the brain, and remember, harking back to the very basis of what we're talking about, these cells are damaged. They are leaking. The electrolytes aren't moving between them. The neurotransmitters don't work and aren't in the same proportions that they used to be. We can actually sample these in the blood. So they go from inside the CSF, they cross into the blood, and there are about at least a dozen different biomarkers being studied now, because if we can detect them in blood, we can say conclusively we've got evidence of damage.
Okay.
So the MRI is normal, the person has signs or symptoms, and they have these biomarkers. So we can make the diagnosis, it's concussion, it's been evidenced by these biomarkers, but importantly, those biomarkers should go back to their normal levels over the course of time. That's the healing process. So if you've got a chemical that says damage and it goes up acutely once you've done the damage and you monitor it over the next 7 to 10 days, you'll see it come down and back to normal.
Right.
So biomarkers show a great promise, not just in the initial diagnosis, but in this whole safe return to play process by saying, okay, your signs and symptoms have abated, although that's very subjective too, because players will lie about them. They want to get back on the field. There's all sorts of pressures on them. So just asking subjective questions isn't going to give us the answer. We need objective tests like our balance tests, like the King Debeck test that I mentioned before, because if you were slower on that than the baseline when you first were injured, chances are over 7 to 10 days, you'll return to normal if you test. And if you're testing for biomarkers and they go up, their levels go up acutely in injury, and they come back to normal, you can say, okay, safe to go back out and play.
Got to move on because we've got two more calls we've got to get to. Emmanuel, good morning.
G'day. There was a documentary on SBS this week about hands, and this lady had examined Muhammad Ali's hand, and she described it as hard as a rock or a stone. And I'm just wondering to ask the doctor, if he could punch that hard, and his hands are that hard, I'm surprised that he didn't even kill anybody, you know, with these big knockout punches. So
that's a very, very good point.
That one, doctor.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, when you talk about boxing, everybody goes, and the boxing fraternity will get up and say, our sport's safe, and we stop the fight, and anything like this. When you think about all the training bouts leading up to that, the number of times you've got to go through it, and you might be wearing soft headgear when you're boxing, but again, you're still absorbing force. And the force doesn't change when your hands are harder, but the muscle power, the shoulder action behind it, the weight of the person behind it, all contributes to the force being delivered from one person to another, and that's what does the damage.
All right, George, not a lot of time, mate, so fire away. What would you like to ask?
Yeah, yeah. Well, George Foreman used to have a cut people and lift them off the floor. So,
yeah.
But I just wanted to ask about sometimes in football, and you also see it with one-punch attacks that have been in the news so much, where the damage often gets done when people aren't expecting the blow.
Right.
And they don't tense themselves and get ready as they might do if they see it coming. So I just wondered if you wanted to comment on what research might have shown up with
okay.
that.
Okay, and what people can actually do, can they brace themselves and prevent damage?
Well, you've actually come across an important point. You're talking about the rotational forces. And, you know, we do measure force up to, in G-forces, up to 180G and over 100G regularly. But you think about that, someone being tackled or tackling, you're braced, you're prepared, you see it coming. It's the glancing sideways blow or the roundhouse punch, you know, the coward punch, when you're not expecting it, which imparts a rotational force. And our bodies don't deal well with rotation. You can jump up and down all day and your muscles are fine. But if you jump up and twist on the way down, suddenly you damage ligaments and suddenly you damage tendons. So our bodies are not meant to deal with those kinds of forces, and our brain is the same. And it's the case that if you measure the rotational forces, as we do with these X2 biosensors, then you actually find some large figures. And we're talking about 10,000 radians per second squared, which is typically the figure and above, that is thought to cause concussion or the sort of damage that we know produces symptoms. And we record regularly 15, 16, 17, 20,000 radians per second squared. So Yeah, rotational force is a key component, one that's poorly understood and one that we've got to do some more research on to work out how we can actually protect ourselves, because you can protect with the linear force by bracing itself. It's much harder with rotational force.
Dr. Adrian Cohen has been our guest this morning, director and founder of HeadSafe. There's so much more that we could talk about, and I'm sorry that we didn't have time for it, but Doctor, thank you very much, and thanks for the great work that you're doing.
You're very welcome.
I really appreciate it. Dr. Adrian Cohen this morning. Well, that's another podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.